Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah. Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. Back in the rugby dungeon. This is the most wholesome podcast we've ever recorded.
Is this not like how they used to record Cheers?
With a live studio audience.
This podcast was recorded in front of a live in-studio audience. And there was one of them just coughing.
You okay, girls?
You right, Bell?
You say right, hello. All right, and that's all you get, so you've got to leave now. Go on, off you go. Bye, bye.
You can listen like everyone else on Monday morning.
Just download it on your various devices. Leave us a review.
5-star review. You shut that door, please. Bye. You shut that door, please.
Oh, this is born in a barn.
Thank you. I'm Tim, that's JB.
Hello, Tim.
Whose daughters are adorable, and that's Phil.
Hello, Tim.
Right, well, thank you very much for listening. If you haven't already, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcast, just like those two girls are off to do on their devices. And you can find more content. We did an extra podcast last week. Some of the feedback was lots positive, and then some constructive feedback was they wanted more gossip from Paris.
No.
The gossip wasn't dirty enough from Paris. But there is more content. Patreon.com/eggchasers, and we appreciate you supporting us there.
Well, talking of more content, can I just make a quick announcement?
Yes, please.
Well, our Egg Chasers feed this week might be having an additional podcast in it.
Exciting. Tell me more.
Which will be the Business of Rugby podcast, until I find a better name for it, which will be me.
Rugby Biz.
Rugby Biz. Yeah, which will be me and Mark Evans discussing the world of rugby business. We'll probably try and do it once a month, just out on our normal feed until we decide what to do with it, maybe put it on its own feed. But that will be in the Egg Chasers feed.
Beers and Biz.
Yeah, exactly right. Mark, all the way from, dialing in all the way from Fiji. Which is actually really amazing. Interesting.
That is really interesting, yeah. So any ideas for a name for that, please?
Egg Chasers,
business,
something or other.
Rugby business.
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 Business, business.
Rugby business chat.
Yeah.
So far, this is sounding like an Alan Partridge brainstorm, so I'll move on. I'm looking forward to that. That's good. Right, we've got lots to talk about on this. Six Nations, obviously, round two, and various other rugby stories. And we always take some weird and wonderful tangents. So where shall we begin?
Ooh, well, so here's a few things I want to talk about. There's one thing I'm definitely going to talk about, and that would be my experience this week watching somebody who was responsible for organising the Rugby World Cup, the Rugby League World Cup, that is, and just the sheer horror of what he had to say.
Oh, that's a great tease, that. Let's keep that one up our sleeve. What a good tea. You're getting good at this, man.
No, thanks, mate.
Because Rugby League organisation, the one thing that always springs, or two things that always spring to mind. Rendezvous Hotel in Wakefield for the club call.
Yeah.
And that photograph
of Tony Adams.
Tony Adams.
In the Leisure Centre.
With the Michael Jordan quote behind him.
And also the vending machine behind
him. Vending machine.
It was so easy to get that right, and they
didn't quite, did they?
They got it so wrong.
Didn't quite.
Within that sports hall, there must have been dozens of other places that they could have done it in the gym. They could have done it in the sports hall with like equipment behind them. But
all right, well let me we'll get to that. But let me do a quick segue from that. Then, devil's advocate, if I were a rugby league fan tuning into the Six Nations, would I just be saying, "Oh, it's just kick and clap"?
So I'm very good friends with a rugby league fan in CrossFit, my friend Mark, and we have these conversations, or not even conversations, they're basically little digs at rugby union. And I just think it is psychologically entrenched that they just do not like rugby union. And I kind of get it. Yeah, I really do get it. Rugby league's an amazing game. It's all action. But it is refined sugar, isn't it? That's what you're watching with rugby league. It's the same thing over and over again. And I'm all for that. I think there's a place for that. And rugby union, of all things, has benefited enormously from it. Enormously. Anyone who watches rugby union and does not appreciate rugby league is not a rugby fan, in my opinion, whatsoever. But I don't think you can make the same argument the other way around. I think it's perfectly reasonable to like rugby league and not like rugby union.
Yeah, I think there is an argument for that, but I think there's a greater level of complexity to rugby league, rugby union, obviously, and that will put people off. But as someone who's kind of into rugby union, as all of us three in the studio are, and probably most people listening to this are, I think you appreciate it. And like, to one of the sections of play this weekend that would have been any rugby league fan and anyone who's not up to speed would be criticising would be the kind of weird kicking duel halfway through the second half in the Scotland-France game, which got to the point of Ramos and Finn Russell basically standing still for 10, 15 seconds at a time, which, if you look at that in total isolation, is patently absurd. But when you link that back to the laws that have been exploited by teams, and particularly Anton DuPont, in the last couple of years, and you follow that, the thread of that history through, I think it's absolutely fascinating that you get to this point.
Do you know, I think there's another element of that. So this weekend, the two key games, which were the England-Wales game and the France-Scotland game, were full of weird battles, which you have to understand rugby to understand where these games won and lost. Ireland did not have any weird battles. They were very straightforward. And I think these weird little battles that we're getting is actually a product of how close the teams are. So if you're really, really close, there's parity between the two sides, then you have to engage in these little 5% duels here and there, whereas Ireland could do whatever they wanted, really. And that's the difference. The really good teams can still basically play entertaining rugby, but you need a huge mismatch in order to do it.
There is that little exchange you describe in the Scotland-France game. I think you can objectively say it's interesting, and you can objectively say it was dull.
Yeah, there. At that time, I found it interesting because I was trying to work out, like, where do they go next? Like, what is just to stop when Scotland are up in that scenario? What is just to stop Finn Russell standing there for 10, 15, 20, and force France to come up and chase? Now, he never pushed it to the fullest limit. I still found it interesting, but I know we're kind of in the 1% of those.
Well, this goes back to my netball point. Okay, so when I was watching netball, the detail that the commentators could go into, because they were involved in the game and they care about the viewer and they care about explaining the nuances in the game, allowed them to explain all sorts of weird stuff. We still don't really get that in rugby because of the complexities of the game. It's almost like the commentators and the analysts are wishing for the sort of game that they want rather than explain the kind of game you're going to get.
To be fair, I would imagine Six Nations weekend, any of the Six Nations weekend on BBC and ITV, the viewership will hopefully and probably be 100x. Yeah. The netball on Sky, there might be a few thousand people watching. It might even be 1,000x. There might be multiple millions versus a few thousand people.
We're talking between six to eight million is a standard Six Nations audience.
Yeah, so it probably is close to 1,000 times the netball figures.
I would say this much. Did you listen to Dan Bigger? It was Dan Bigger, Johnny Wilkinson, and somebody else on ITV.
Jamie Roberts, Dan
Bigger, Johnny Wilkinson, yeah. Jamie Roberts and Lawrence Dahlia.
I think Dan Bigger and Johnny Wilkinson are just leagues apart in explaining what happened in that game. Their analysis at the end was awesome.
I really enjoyed those two. I'm really pleased to see Bigger, because when you get him kind of out of the heat of battle, I think he's a really interesting, well-considered individual.
He is, isn't he?
If you listen to him when he is in the heat of battle, you basically don't want to listen to him. Yeah, I find him really interesting. And the, like, as an example, the way that those two handled and talked through the conversion charge down, I thought was really interesting. And then you've got to, like, Lawrence Dallaglio and Jamie Roberts might as well not have been there for that part of the conversation, because they are not going to add anything ahead of two of the best tens of the last 20 years.
It's a very strategic game, that, in the end. Very strategic game. So it does take your playmaking fly halves of the modern era to describe it, because I don't think anyone else really kind of understands it.
Yeah, people with captaincy experience outside the fly half should position should do, but...
Recent retired scrum half, something like that.
Yeah.
But it's few and far between.
So yeah, there's not many.
So just on the overall feel. Okay, so and again, I'm not wanting to pour negativity on, because you know, I love this sport. We sit here every Sunday night talking about it. So that's not the purpose. But I was in Twickenham, and the atmosphere again was morgue-like for large
chunks. Twickenham. I mean, I've been saying this for decades.
Twickenham when it's bouncing, and to be fair, the last 20 minutes was awesome, but. That was partly a consequence of the way that the game was officiated at scrum time, the length of the reset. They actually showed a clip in some of the... where did I see the clip? There was something on telly where I saw them showing Scott Gibbs' try in the 99 match at Wembley. And that was 23 years ago. You always think about those ridiculously quick set scrums in the 70s.
Yeah.
And even up to the early 90s.
But this was 1999. Professionalism had already kicked in. We'd had South Africa Lions, living with Lions. That had all happened by this point. And there was no messing.
A few things have happened to produce this. One, the absolute pathological illness, which is the pursuit of safety.
I'm fine with the pursuit of safety on the engagement on the engage itself.
But it takes two. I mean, you got a setup.
The setup's ridiculous. It doesn't need to take that long. I don't accept that.
I'd like to watch it with you, and I'd like you to tell me what you'd like to speed up, because to me, there is a way to set up a scrum. It has to be deliberate. It has to be process driven, and that's just how it is.
Second rows, when there's a reset scrum, second rows do not need to unbind from each other, stand up, props pull the mud off the bottom of their boots.
They definitely need
look around, tuck their shirt in.
The mud definitely needs to come off, and the shirts need to be right. The shirts do need to be right. Because you've got to bind on those things. It's silly little things, but if you're going to do that, you've got to be comfortable.
I'd like to think there is some way of speeding it up.
I think
certain teams...
It was dire.
Certain teams use it to their advantage as well.
The problem being here is that the initial setup can take 10 seconds. But what you don't want is a second setup and a third setup and a fourth setup. And that's where you run into problems. I do agree with you. The standing up and, you know, that is the bit where it needs to get slicker. But maybe you say, look, you've got two opportunities, max.
Because the 10 seconds is... I mean, you're lucky if you get it done in under a minute.
Yeah, for the, like, each one.
Certainly the first one. And then it's most of that. It's probably 30 to 45 seconds for every subsequent one.
I think there was a couple of times in that, was it in the middle period, I can't remember which side of half time it was, where there was two times, there was over 3 minutes to get one scrum done.
I have to say, I don't like blaming the ref, because I think he's going to come into for a fair bit of criticism for different things. But in this case, I think the ref might not have handled it so well. And the reason I say that is because England outmatched Wales so comprehensively that to me they just looked like a series of England penalties. I mean, it wasn't even close up front.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah. As an England fan, having lost a couple of very important, very high-profile games in the World Cup to South Africa in the last few years, primarily because of a lack of a scrum, it's actually quite nice to be on the other end of a victory and having a competent scrum.
That much is true. And look, as I say, I didn't want to pour negativity on it, but one thing I am conscious of, that the Netflix documentary's happened, I'm hoping that will lead to, we'll wait and see what the viewing figures are, whether it actually has translated into more interest. But I just fear that if people with new enthusiasm for rugby tuned into that Six Nations, they're not going to come back for round three.
I don't know. I mean, it was an exciting game. There was lots of it. I thought it was a really good game, actually. I mean,
the Scotland, France and England, Wales, basically going down to the final minute.
100%.
That is always good to see. Some of the passages of play, I try to think, were there any good tries?
Oh, the Ben White try was ace for Scotland.
Ben White try was super, with Patterson going through.
Yeah, and Alex Mann's try was great for Wales.
Mann's try was superb. The Fiku try was in the corner, was good. The Biel Barry try. Yeah, so there was
some really good
some
rugby.
Lovely tries. The Scotland-France, particularly that second half, it was so... like neither team really wanted to play.
No, and that was the odd thing about Scotland. And as much as... And we can talk about the refereeing decision there for sure, but they... and they've done it twice now. They just kind of stopped playing. They did it against Wales.
Mm. Yeah.
Stopped taking risks. It's kind of like you've got Finn Russell and Duan van der Merwe in your
team. Keep going.
Yeah.
And you know...
And Hugh Jones, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And Kyle Rowe, who had that amazing break towards the end. Like, you've got good runners, good strike runners. You've got to use them. And it's funny because in the at the end of the first half, like going into a little bit of detail on the Scotland-France game after bouncing around... the end of the first half, they kept playing probably too long because they had two kickable players, not just kickable players, they were right in front of the post.
Yeah.
Got a second penalty and went for the scrum, went to keep playing because they were a man up, but didn't get the ball wide. And so they got burnt then, but instead of continuing that, they just retreated into their shell and didn't
do
anything.
To be fair though, I do kind of get what happened there from a Scottish point of view. Because even when Scotland were ahead and at their best, it felt like France were only ever a play or two away from breaking.
I totally agree.
I completely agree. But then that's why they shut.
Yeah. So they risked it and rolled the dice just before halftime. But then they came out in the second half and went, "We're not going to play.
Yeah, we're never going to play ever again because we've had our fingers burnt once." You've got to keep, if you're going to do that, you kind of got to keep rolling the dice.
This reminds me, there was a stat about Michael Vick when he came back to the Philadelphia Eagles, and the stat was he had the most lucky passes completed. So that would be like he would throw the ball and like it would
bounce off someone's helmet.
Yeah, and then they'd catch it, and he had the most lucky passes completed. And that's just an example of somebody playing a game, and it's not wise just to continue to gamble in that way. And I think if Scotland tried to continue to play against France, eventually it would have gone wrong. Now, it did go wrong. And the reason I think that is because one of the things France were very keen on doing is turning over and attacking from turnover ball.
Yeah.
They weren't that bothered, really, about launching their own attacks. They were bothered about possession, winning some set piece, and then scoring. But if Scotland decide to run into them time and time again, that's when they're dangerous, because they will turn you over at some point. So just to kick the ball away, get the French bored. I don't think that's a terrible idea.
But that it was the end of that, of a very long passage of play that was kick, 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 that led to actually Scotland becoming bored, Finn Russell trying to fly hacked it into, was it Schumann?
Yeah.
His midriff.
Yeah.
And that led to the scrum, that led to ultimately the try. So it was actually Scotland
who got bored. Well, yeah.
Finn Russell got bored.
I mean, there's also the question, how wise is it to play a game like that when you've got Finn Russell on your team? Because he will get bored. And he did get bored.
Yeah. Yeah. Although he is a very good controlling kicker. Some of his kicks, first half this week particularly in the first half last week, absolutely superb.
Mm.
But you're right, he maybe sometimes wants to do more exciting things than that.
Rightly so. I mean, that Scotland backline is pretty
dynamite.
Tasty, isn't it?
And when Blair Kinghorn and Darcy Graham come back for the England game, I mean...
they're going to be good.
Tasty.
They just need a pack that is, broadly speaking, comparable to other packs.
Serviceable, which I think they have. Like
They're not far off, are they?
They were never bullied at scrum time in that game, I'm trying to...
don't forget they're without Luke Crosby, who's a big strong boy, and he looked good last week. He was out injured. Richie Gray's out for the Six Nations. They don't have a lot of depth, so they lose a few players and they're suddenly...
Yeah.
Tell you who I love.
Feels like if you lose a prop, they've got a prop as well.
Big problem.
Yeah, well, there's a few... So they were better on the breakdown this week. I love Richie. I think he is a phenomenal player. He's so unusual.
Yeah, well, he was surplus to requirements for this one. Yeah. Like, in starting, two out of the 23.
And I get it, because last week on the breakdown, he takes so many risks, and he's so good for a tall, rangy guy of just stealing ball, and he does it in the most...
good line-out forward as well.
...unorthodox way. But yeah, I think I'd have dropped him too, but he is useful.
Yeah, but Rory Darge is a potential... I think that's a British and Irish Lion. That's a Scotland captain. That is a 100 capper right there in that lad. He is awesome.
He is a class player. And sticking with this game, but just open side flankers who are awesome players. Tommy Raffel.
Oh, my word.
Yes.
So he had Wales won that, he would have been man of the match.
Yeah, 100%. Arguably, he should have been man of the match anyway.
Regardless. I tend to agree.
Here's a question, because JB has said this before, and I think you're bang on. There are certain players, because they're not prototypical, England don't select. Do you think Tommy Raphael would be one of those guys that would be tearing it up in the Premiership, but if he was English, he wouldn't get picked in the international squad?
The closest thing I can think of is...
Will Evans
from Harlequins, that's exactly the one.
So there is a guy in the England squad who's probably not that dissimilar in Underhill. I don't see as being wildly dissimilar in stature. Maybe not quite as good over the ball, but Underhill hits a bit harder.
He does hit so hard. He hits so hard.
Who did he put in a great hit on?
Oh, he put in a couple of big hits.
One of the props. Domichel?
Yeah. Oh, no, it was... yes. It wasn't Domichel. It was the one who started.
Oh, God.
Acerati.
Was it Thomas?
Anyway, it was one of them. One of the two props.
It was
absolutely
a beautiful
ended him.
Hit.
It was a great hit. But you're right. But he sort of had all that hype when he was young, whereas Tommy Raphael's been sort of largely under the radar. And then he's just... he's been best back row in the tournament so far.
He's been superb. Yeah.
Shall we do that refereeing decision on the Scotland game very, very quickly?
Yes.
So I think it's completely understandable. It could go either way because that's how the laws are written. And don't ask for consistency in application of the law if you're not happy with the consistency in application of the law. That's what I would say.
Can I get everything apart from the last... What was that last point?
So we want a process and consistent application of the law. Right? The law is all based around what was the referee's decision on the field.
Yeah.
So that has to have primacy. And then after that, you have to have absolute certainty to overturn that. And I think that's right. Now, if they did overturn it, I feel as
the reason he had to have absolute certainty is because Nick Berry said that he didn't just say, I couldn't see anything. Mm. He said, I've seen it held up.
Well, what we did
is that what
see,
he said?
Yeah. He says it's held up, right?
He now said,
he signalled held up.
So he saw it held up. So, yeah, once he's gone that with that certainty, I'm making the call that it's held up. And I suppose I can't be hypocritical about this. I want referees to be decisive and make calls. And he made a call. But I would say that was a wrong call. And I don't understand how Nick Berry could look at that and say with certainty it was held up. I'd have preferred it if he'd gone, I couldn't tell with that one. I had no clear sight.
Do they have to make a decision?
Yeah, I think they push to make a decision.
I think they do.
But even if the decision is no clear grounding, can you give me a clear? Can you give me? Therefore, it's no try. So, can you give overturn that?
I wouldn't have minded it if he'd have said, "I wasn't sure about that. Can you just show me on the big screen?" Okay, I'm going to make a call. I'm happy that that's a try.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
he sort of boxed himself into a corner,
close to where I am. In that, I'm surprised he. Because he was the closest man. He was closer than any camera. And he can move. Like, he's not rigidly fixed in one position. He can, as soon as that ball goes down, he can rotate a few degrees to the left.
There's two things I'd like to say about this. Although, currently, I can only remember one of them. So, the first thing is, when that try was scored, and when we watched it subsequently on the replay, they're rocking and rolling it, but they don't show what happened later. And if you remember how Nick Berry gives that try, he's kind of hanging around that ruck, that breakdowny sort of situation. It takes him about, in my head, it takes him about 5 seconds to make his decision. Now, what we didn't see, we saw the ball grounded, but we don't see what happens afterwards. Does a French hand get underneath it to protest to Nick Berry that they've held it up? Does Nick Berry actually see it held up subsequent to being grounded? Because it looks grounded to me. But what did Nick Berry see at the time? And we don't know that. So I'm pretty confident that Nick Berry would have seen a ball held up. Because the French wouldn't have just said, oh yeah, look, it's on the ground, sir. You know, they would have done something subsequent to it being grounded. They always do. That's the first thing. The second thing on why these decisions are made, is it not to speed up the game? Isn't the idea that the referee makes a decision, and once that decision is made, they're not going to spend hours, I've never spent hours, I think, but minutes just trying to decipher what happened. Here is the decision. Can you overturn it? Yes or no? If it's a no, then you've got to go with the decision. Whereas if it's kind of ambiguous, what happened there? There's two things that happen. Every single decision will go to the TMO, which a lot of them do, but also that TMO process becomes a little bit longer because you don't have the initial decision to work from.
So I'm fine with that, like the speed of the initial decision. And I think it was actually fast. I think he went very fast to say held up. And it's because he saw it land on the foot and then the ball kind of moved away from him, and as it rolled off the foot.
But you know, if he's called it held up, and that's another thing, right? If he's called it held up when it's on the boot, it doesn't matter if it is grounded.
If he's blown his whistle,
it doesn't matter.
Then you've got to determine when he blows his whistle.
Yeah, exactly. And you've not got sound. So if he's said held up and it's on the boot, it's definitely held up.
But then I do think there was, so get the process, get the referee's got to do it straight away, and get then you need kind of conclusive evidence that the ball has been grounded and or it, you can award a try.
I mean, imagine.
But I think in this scenario there was I was very satisfied that the ball.
Yes, you cannot be in that circumstance. You could not say with 100% certainty. Yeah. But if you want to use the courtroom analogy, that was a try beyond a reasonable doubt.
I just thought of something, right? That's, imagine how annoyed you'd be if you held up the ball. The referee says held up, and then you let the ball go, and they ground it, and because there's no sound on the replay, they say, oh, it wasn't held up, look, it's grounded.
Goes down.
So you do have to go with this decision. You have to go with this decision.
I still don't think you do.
I don't think,
even if he called held up, blew the whistle, and then...
Oh, if that happened,
if that happened.
But
if that clear, yeah.
You can't see that on
no,
the...
No, if that happened, then yes.
Yeah, I don't think...
But that's not what
happened
in this
case. I don't think that is what happened.
Well, the answer is I'm not actually sure, and I'm starting to doubt myself. I think he took some time to watch it, and then it was grounded and held up. Well, you seem to think it was immediate. So
no, let's put that to one side because
that's
obfuscating the conversation.
The bigger thing is Scotland turning down multiple 3 points, although they lost by 4 points, but turning down multiple 3 points that would have put them further ahead going in at half time, and then they were only lucky to get the ball back for that final play. Because Cairo made an amazing break and then knocks on looking for the offload. Yeah, so like, you can't bemoan, as we always say, you can't bemoan a single referee indecision if you have failed to take multiple
chances.
They
deserve to lose because they left it. They left,
they left it in the hands of an official.
Yeah. Like,
I do think the having to have 100% certainty is an unreasonable bar to set, and there should be some leeway to go. I'm happy that was. In all probability, that was a try. That's what they do when they give
a penalty try.
Penalty tries.
Yeah, you
can't be certain that a penalty try was going to be scored, but you have beyond a reasonable doubt. You're like, I'm fairly.
If he'd have given the try, I'd have no problem with it.
Yeah.
And because he's not given the try, in some way, and I just don't think it's a big issue.
As you can imagine, we've had quite a bit of contact on this, so it might be interesting just to canvass some of the opinions.
How about Captain David Heathcote, who wants to do visual imagery from? Air defence systems in order to work out. I love the principle of it. I think more military technology should be involved in rugby. I'm just not sure the feasibility of it.
Contact deadchasers@gmail.com. This one from Ben Richards with the subject alternative take on the Scotland try. Blah, 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 blah. Overwhelming feeling is that refs have too much of an impact on the game, but not sure how you'd think to fix that. On the Scotland try, I think we all agree it was a try. Maybe JB doesn't, but fine. But I do have a slightly different view on it. Whilst we see the ball down, you don't actually see any evidence it's down over the line. If the ref said held up over the line, do you think they'd have given it? There's conclusive evidence it's grounded, but not conclusive that it's over the line as well.
But so Berry did signal that it was held up.
So it must be over the line.
So it's got over the line. And was it... If they had conclusive proof, or if they believe they had conclusive proof of the grounding, which they did not, I'm certain they would have gone for a higher up angle to see. Like, it's not beyond the technical.
Can you imagine if this had happened in France? We don't have any angles.
Sorry.
Which is kind of what happened in the England game, actually. They wait
available.
For ages to get some TMO angles.
Just on that. Referees have too much impact on the game. What can we do to reduce it? I don't want them to reduce it. You know, it's fine the way it is.
It's TMOs have. If anything, it's TMOs in the bunker has.
TMOs,
I feel like Nick Berry had seen enough for him to be able to give that try.
Yeah,
100%.
On the replays, not initially. And then the TMO talked him out of it.
Initially, the TMO was talking like, oh, yeah, it's grounded. And then talked him back out of it.
Yeah. He was talking very legalistically, wasn't he? He said, I cannot be absolutely certain.
Yeah.
So just on the referee, how do you... You know, remove his influence. It's not the referee's influence. It's how the players react to the referee. And that's part of the puzzle of rugby, isn't it? You know, if a referee... I do believe almost all the referees, with the exception of the one who refereed Argentina when they went out in the World Cup against against New Zealand, I thought that was terrible reffing. But most of them, the vast majority, are very fair. They just know how they want the game played. And it's your job as a captain to sort that out.
In that exchange that we talked about with the replays, what is the TMO doing giving his opinion? Nick Berry's there and can see it. The TMO does not need to talk.
I'm kind of with that. Like, it's,
was he not asked a question?
Yeah, but I don't think it's the TMO's job. It's like the TMO, all you actually need is, like, there's a massive screen.
Yeah.
There's a giant screen and Nick Berry's there on the pitch and has the feel for it, knows what he saw and can correlate that can correlate that with what he's seeing on the screen. The TMO is like irrelevant to this conversation, in my mind.
Yeah, I would 100% go for that. Put the referee in, because we spoke about this before where... Some of it's good because it speeds up the game, but referees discharging decisions straight to the bunker, so they don't have to do that thinking. But you're discharging it to someone who has different angles and doesn't have the same level of responsibility, and indeed doesn't have the same level of experience because they're not on the pitch at that point in time. Yeah. So I'm all for speeding up the game. Yeah. I'm not for discharging the referee's
responsibility. To dovetail it, this is one of the things they've introduced to try and speed up the game, yet they're doing nothing about how long scrums take. I would say just get your priorities in order, World Rugby.
I thought the scrums this week they did take a while. I thought that was a bit of an anomaly due to the mismatch of the teams rather than anything else. I think scrums have got much quicker and much better recently. Mm,
okay. Patrick Tipsaw, just to canvas the general feeling people are having, blah, blah, blah. My one question to you is, when can rugby use common sense to award a try? Yes, there was no clear visual of the ball on the line, but saying the ball was held up by a French player's foot is frankly ridiculous, unless he has size 30 feet like Shaquille O'Neal. All rugby players know that it was clearly a try based on ball positioning in the freeze frame at the TMO.
You can see the curve of the ball where that intersects with the ground.
Yeah,
it was only the ground preventing the clear view of the ball on the ground.
And Ben Stokes, maybe England cricketer Ben Stokes, I'm pretty sure he's listening to the pod. He says, as a rare England fan and huge fan of Eddie Jones, hear me out. I may like to add my two cents that as custodians of the great game of rugby, our biggest takeaway from the Scotland try, no try controversy should be that we need a fundamental shift back to referee responsibility. Along the lines of what we were saying just then. I don't know exactly when top-level rugby lost this idea, but it needs to be crystal clear that the referee is in charge of big gameplay decisions like try or no try.
It's kind of what happened.
Yeah. The TMO did chip in and talked him off
the
of
initial
the try.
Decision.
It was,
it was the initial decision.
But then Nick Berry, I am certain he was talking as if he's changed his mind, and it was the TMO who said no. And so so one of the last things Nick Berry said was, so you are saying you can't confirm that it was on the ground, and the TMO said, yes, I can't confirm it's on the ground. So that is passing the book.
Yeah, and that's where England cricketer Ben Stokes said that's what Eddie Jones has previously said.
It's interesting, isn't it,
to
hear from the captain of a different sport and his point of view.
Yeah. Very good.
And then Daniel Robbie says...
Margot's brother.
Yeah, Margot Robbie. Well, he's in Australia, quite possibly. He says, I was waking up at 1 a.m. to watch two games of rugby, and just as they finish, my two boys under five wake up and want to play cricket. You think, why I bother? Anyway, so gets on to the decision. The last 60 seconds was a killer for me, and I wanted them to both lose. I really feel for the unfair backlash Nick Berry and the TMO are getting now. Nick Berry called what he saw, the ball held up. He checked with the TMO to ensure he had not missed anything. The TMO showed the ball slipping from the French boot, which could have been grounded. But one point I have is no one complaining is mentioning the location of the ball. And again, it's about whether it was...
Do you know, one of the things I hate the most in rugby at the moment is this obsession with backlashes and abuse. Just absolute obsession. So we had last week, didn't we, the intense obsession about potential abuse towards... what's his name? The winger? Feo Wabuso. It's like it dominates everything. And most of it isn't even true. Like, oh, we saw what Tom Curry went through. Turn off your Twitter. Just stop talking about it. Like, this continual narrative of backlash and abuse over and over again because it's the trendy thing to talk about because of the mental health grifters.
Well,
like, it just does my head.
If we put that to one side and just talk about the... I'm not going to go as far as say abuse, but the... I was at Twickenham and I had the ref link earpiece in. Mm. So I didn't hear the TV comms, but I was just listening to the referee and the players. And you hear a lot. Like, to the point you actually hear the breathing of the players at the breakdown. You can hear a load of them. You know, like boxers, when they punch, go...
Yeah.
Rugby players.
Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing to listen to. Anyway, that is one thing that struck me. It's like there's a refs after, like, we've been critical here. My God, they have to put up with a load of verbals. It's non-stop.
Because, of course, if you when I used to watch Cell Sharks train, one of the things that stood out to me is how much they talk, right? So the really good players, really senior players, and the biggest difference between the academy and the senior players was how much they were talking. So going into a scrum, they're literally saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. When they hit, they're all shouting squeeze, they're all driving their legs at the same time. And they know this because of the communication. And that communication during the game spreads to telling the referee what they're doing all the time. And it's just a constant verbal barrage, not in a bad way, but this is what they're trained to do. They're trained to communicate all of the time, even when you're doing something completely.
I don't know if Sir, he's holding on, is telling the ref what they're doing, but I know.
I think it kind of is. You know, they tell their mates and they tell the ref absolutely everything on a continual basis. And that's what they are trained to do, and that's what the best guys do. You watch Dan Bigger; he is telling everybody everything all of the time.
There was one scrum in this halfway through the second half in the England Wales game, where the camera focused in on Ben Earl for 15, 20 seconds. And for the entirety of that 15, 20 seconds, he was just barking orders at the people in front of him. You couldn't hear anything. You just no idea if it was good, bad, made any sense or what. But he was just constantly communicating.
I bloody love Ben Earl. I love him celebrating knock-ons.
He's so enthusiastic.
He's so good.
Ben Earl's a great example. You can imagine him constantly going into a line-out saying, he's going to jump. Watch him.
Yeah.
You can just imagine this stuff.
I've got him. Do you know one thing that was noticeable as well in terms of just comms between teammates? And it will annoy some people. I know the Ben Earl thing winds some people up. But every time the forwards did anything, held up a maul and it got a turnover, won a scrum pen, every single member of the whole England back line ran in to give someone a little pat on the backside. And I loved it.
Yeah. Can I just say regarding Ben Earl, right? The people that criticise Ben Earl for being enthusiastic, if they were half as enthusiastic about their day job as Ben Earl is about his, they might be successful. But they're not. They're not successful, and Ben Earl is because he's enthusiastic.
It's hard to get that enthusiastic about typing numbers into a spreadsheet for 8 hours.
But you do
every
it.
Day. I do. I'm one of the few people who can muster that level of enthusiasm.
Well, if you love your work, you'll never work again.
Exactly. Have we successfully moved on to England Wales?
I think so.
Yeah, we were talking about referees. And the never-ending discussion on referees. I love this game. I don't see many downsides to it. So the first thing I'd say is I think some of the things Wales are doing are truly remarkable. I do think this is going to be a fantastic team at some point. I don't know when, but it will be.
Gatland is one of the first things he said in his post-match press conference was, these boys, they're special, they're going places, but they're not quite there yet. Like, it will take some time.
It will take some time because they're so young. They're so young, they're so inexperienced. Some of the players in that team, they do not have the quality that England have. They had nowhere near the quality that England had. But their best players played better than England's best players. You know, Raphael was superb. I thought Tompkins was an absolute leader. I love Rio Dyer. I don't know why I really appreciate him.
He's like
Rio
a dog
before.
Chasing after a ball in the park.
God, I love him.
He's
like young Johnny May.
Yeah.
He was really good. Like his kick chasing and the cross. There was a crossfield kick early in the first half where he tracked it over his shoulder. And if he misses it, which is a very, very hard crossing over his shoulder into towards the touchline, if he misses it, it's England try time. And he absolutely nailed it.
I love his work rate. I love his, just everything about him. I love him. I didn't think that I liked him before. I absolutely love him now.
Cam Winnett's got something about him.
Cam Winnett. I mean, the only thing he needed to cure his first international game was a second international game.
Yeah, that tackle he made on Elliot Daly, who's must be 5-10 kg heavier than him in the corner, was superb.
They're doing this with hardly any experience. They've got no front row whatsoever. I mean, the front row situation is
disastrous. In the Cabbage Patch pub before the match, I started chatting to a gentleman because he had a very fetching blazer on, and it was a red blazer with white stripes, and it had a little leak on the pocket, and it was a Welsh Barbarians blazer. So I was asking him about his blazer. I got chatting, and it was Archie Griffin's dad.
Wow, I was about to mention Archie Griffin.
So. He's played, and obviously he was like bursting with pride, as you'd imagine. Archie Griffin does not look like an international player yet. Nope. when he came on. He's only played 111 minutes of senior rugby. He
I
was
know.
Like, oh, you know? I stayed with my brother, and I mentioned he dropped me off at the stadium, and he was telling me, oh yeah, Archie Griffin was on loan with us at Richmond.
So just on Archie
Griffin,
man. Yeah.
I didn't look at the team sheet before the game. And he came on, and I was like, I recognise that boy. I recognise him. The reason I recognised him is because he came on for Bath, didn't he, against somebody recently.
The last game.
Was it the last game that he played?
Yeah, against Bristol.
Yeah, possibly.
He came on.
And it just struck
me. Because Will Stewart was not involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just struck me how young he looked. Yeah. And that's why he stuck in my mind. And then all of a sudden, I'm seeing this guy in a Welsh jersey, like, who is it? I know him. Then when it clicked, it was like the young kid with 3 minutes experience against Bristol or whatever it is.
Yeah,
I mean, that's I can't imagine. Well, actually, is it more or less terrifying to have hardly any minutes for Bath and go into a Wales game?
I mean, if you've had 10 games of senior rugby and had your ass handed to you 10 times in a row going into international rugby, would be pretty terrifying.
I mean, yes. At least he actually got capped, because that's one of the things that his dad in the pub did say. He said, oh, you know, I'll be incredibly proud if he gets on, because that what's his name, Matthias, the week before didn't get a minute,
yeah,
and then wasn't in the 23. So
well, he came on, he's straight up against Genge. I was thinking, well, he's got to do this for his day job anyway, so you may as well get into it.
Yeah
there's no reason why not. But it's probably less scary, isn't it, than having 2 years in the Premiership and thinking that this is your one chance to make it in international.
Yeah,
you know, you've been there 2 minutes, you've been to international. Even if he fails now and gets released back to Bath, he can just rebuild his career pretty much immediately. I mean, there's absolutely no shame and no risk in what he had to go through. Again, crikey, it must have been terrifying.
It must have been absolutely. When England bring 150 odd caps off the bench in their two props, and Wales bring eight.
Yeah. It's not even that. I mean, I've walked onto Twickenham, onto the field, when it's empty. And maybe the emptiness is what makes it feel so vast. When that place is full, walking onto that field must be terrifying.
Yeah.
When your previous experience was Richmond. Christ almighty.
So what about this email then? Just jumping over to England, Edmund Levin. Contact edchasers@gmail.com is where you can get in touch with us. Right, he says, the issue at hand, I'm seeing as increasingly frustrating levels of obstinance coming from both England fans and other countries' fans. England are clearly a team in transition, who are making a massive effort to be a lot more open and transparent with the media and public. This is evidenced through their brilliant YouTube series.
Brilliant YouTube series?
This Rose and Inside Line, although Egg Chasers is very good as
That's
well.
That's the one.
Which Edmund does actually say. I just didn't put that at the start. Humble.
Good.
He says, blah, 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 blah. So basically makes the point they're opening up. And he is accusing, just going through this, he is accusing people of having England derangement syndrome. EDS, he claims, is a thing.
Okay.
It started before the World Cup, but it's endemic now in people's minds. They can't help but judge the changing England team through the eyes of their England derangement syndrome. No one in England is claiming to be the best in the world.
Or that's
being,
not true.
Or being
that's
in any true. Way cocky or arrogant.
That's not true.
They're judged as if they were so.
Sorry, that isn't true. That fundamentally isn't true. If you ask the England team, right, before they went to the World Cup, what their intentions are in that World Cup, they'd say to win it. They clearly think that they're the best team in the world.
Any team that was a quote-unquote tier one nation who didn't give that answer is not a true pro athlete.
Okay, fine, right? But you can't make the claim that they're not saying that they're the best in the world. They do believe that they're the best in the world. And they should do as well. That is a completely false claim.
So there is a change in language, because you're right, you have to go to the World Cup saying, we are going to win it.
Yeah.
There is a change in language now, because they all, like Borthwick and Jamie George, are talking about a team in transition.
Mm.
So they are.
Yeah, just
there is a difference
that,
in that.
Is this the Borthwick version? I'm just being devil's advocate here a little bit, because I do think there is some unfair negativity being thrown towards England, and some players in particular. We talked about George Ford last week. But is this a little bit like the Steve Diamond, it's years here, though. After 3 years of not achieving the aim that he was going to achieve at Sale Sharks, he went, no, year zero.
Okay.
England, right, hold on.
First of all,
Steve Borthwick, you're a team in transition. Owen Farrell and Courtney Laws are the only significant players you've lost, and you came within a hair's breadth of a World Cup final. And now you've got largely the same group of players. I would think you should be going, we're kicking on. We're not, we're in transition, it's all change. It's not all change.
Right, okay, so first of all, on the Steve Diamond thing, right, he was so far ahead of his first 5-year plan that he was rebasing for his second five-year plan. I won't hear a bad man said about the world. Bad words said about the man. Sorry. So that's the first thing. So we can shelve that now. Yeah, never talk about it ever again.
Everyone agrees.
Yeah. On the England thing, I mean, yeah, I kind of agree with you. They've lost two senior players. They're a very good team. I think they're probably in transition in terms of the way that they play.
I think it's more that.
Yeah. And I think that during the World Cup, they probably stuck with some of their more senior guys who they would have got rid of anyway. Because of the draw they're in, they thought, "Well, Christ, we'll just go for it. We'll just go for it. We're not going to get a better draw. See what happens." And I think there's a couple of things there. In terms of, one of the things I dislike about England so intensely is, Ellis Genge is one that gets me. Like his cry face, he was doing it again. Like just the obstinate cry face at every scrum time. Like he's just not. Oh, something about him which really winds me up. Really, really winds me up. He's got his ingrained arrogance.
This sounds like England derangement syndrome.
Yeah, it might be Genge derangement syndrome. I don't know. But I like him. I like him as a player in the Open. But sometimes when he gives his interviews and the way he... Kyle Sinclair does the same sort of thing. Jamie George, actually, the other day, giving an interview to BT Sport. He couldn't actually give an interview. He's on the side of the pitch without... Continually referencing, oh, you'll just take this out of context, or you'll just talk about the salary cap. And it was Nick Mullins interviewing him. It wasn't like some hard-nosed journalist. And he just couldn't get it together. Yeah, they have a lot of people with extreme cry faces to England.
I think I saw that, Jamie George, and I think, to me, he is wildly different from Genge in particular, because... If the one that I saw where Jamie George was like a water boy on the side of the pitch with Nick Mullins, he was doing it all in jest. He was doing it. Yeah, he was 100% doing it with a smile on his face.
Many word is spoken in jest.
He's very jovial with that. Whereas Genge, I would he means it. And
I liked it because it made good telly. But the most disappointing interview I've ever done working on rugby was Ellis Genge. We were having a lovely chat beforehand. He was captain in Leicester for the first time. Lewis Ludlow was up against him as captain for Gloucester. And they were at Hartbury College together.
Yeah,
and so
nice.
And so I was chatting to him about that, just kind of almost like priming him, like, when I ask you about this, you'll have already thought about it and might have said something. That's quite often what happens. I'll chat to someone and then I'll go,
yeah.
And as soon as the red light went on, he just gave me one word answers.
Yeah,
I think
I just kept asking questions, which was actually one of the toughest things to think. What the hell do I ask next? But I kept going for did the full 2 minutes of one word answers. I spoke way more than him.
That's ridiculous.
And the director said at the end of it in my ear, "That is a disgrace."
It is a disgrace. It's an absolute.
He started doing that kind of attitude on the pitch as well.
Yes.
It's quite noticeable how little he moves. Like, he will make a tackle and then get up and just stand there and look rather than actually shifting back into the line. Or he'll take the ball and just stand there before... Like, it's like he's announcing himself, letting the world know he's there before he actually does anything.
Isn't that actually like...
It's a total... I was, when he burst onto the scene and when he was a bit younger, I was a huge fan of... him because of the hard work that he put in and what he could do. I think his attitude is prohibiting him from utilising his talents.
Yeah,
because he is undoubtedly phenomenally talented.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Completely agree. So the answer is, why do we not like Ellis Genge?
Well, and there is something. So England, in that first half, conceded 6 penalties to 0.
Mm.
They had the charge down kick, which the referee... sided with Wales and sided against England.
Yep.
There was multiple other decisions where he sided against England. And that's not unusual for England to have penalty after penalty after penalty. And their own attitude compounds to the referee. And this is the point you made before, JB, that to a degree, the referee is a controllable because you can get him on your side and you can say, even if you believe he's wrong, sorry, sir, we won't do it again, sir. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Just be more compliant for him. And I was hoping that would change under Jamie George. Thus far, it hasn't done really. Although I will say, England's penalty count in the second half, they conceded one penalty in the second half, which was probably more to do with the fact that Wales were just crumbling in the tight than any better behaviour.
So this game can be summarised effectively in penalty counts. So to win international games, you need a few things, and I think one of the key indicators now is penalties. So one of the easiest things in the world to do is, well, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do at all, but an easy thing which doesn't require much in the way of skill and practice is not to give away penalties. Wales have got this absolutely nailed until scrum time. So scrum time is the only time that England could squeeze penalties out of them, and it turned out to be critical because, fair play to England, they recognise this, they turned it on in an area of the game Wales could do absolutely nothing about, and that won in the territory, which again allowed them to score their points. There was some, you know, I don't think I've ever seen an international team go a full half without conceding a penalty.
And they only conceded four last week.
Yeah.
Despite all, like, in particular in the first half, all the pressure they were under from Scotland. So they were 120 minutes of rugby up to half time in this year's Six Nations with just four penalties, like that's one every 30 minutes. That really is outstanding.
I mean, this is what people don't really understand, and I'm a huge advocate of saying this over and over again. It is so hard to get a bunch of young men to be that disciplined who are that inexperienced. I mean, I can't... I think that is unprecedented, and that's why I think this...
Because it's even things like... Although, actually, England, Wales didn't have to make that many tackles, but it's even things like someone just getting pinned in a ruck.
Yeah.
Having made a tackle.
Landing on the right side, on the correct side, not the...
You effectively have to work hard and be a little bit smart. And even then, you've got guys like Tommy Rafael who were pilfering the ball who could give away a penalty. So his work must be so precise. That's why he's so brilliant. It must be so precise.
That, to tread that line.
Yeah.
He's right on a razor's edge every time and he falls on the right side of it.
Yeah, that's impressive.
It's remarkable. Yet, they did lose and they lost because they just don't have as much talent as England. And I think one of the things which really highlighted that is the fact England could score a try against them when they had 13 men on the field.
Yeah.
You know, and then the scrummaging.
That was quite remarkable, that Ben Earl carry.
Yeah.
So yeah, without that one Ben Earl carry, and without the scrum,
you shouldn't concede that try.
No, you shouldn't. But it's Ben Earl.
I did watch Fraser Dingwall latches onto him and pushes him over.
Yeah, yeah.
It was quite smart rugby as well. That.
Yeah. I thought he should have been given the assist for it.
Dingwall's settling in pretty well.
He's had a few. There was a couple of
passes.
Wasn't
great last week.
Yeah, and there was a couple of passes this week where he got the ball kind of a bit scrappy and he shoveled shit. He, like, passed it out the back because he'd taken it behind him, facing the wrong way, and he then passes it to Noah. So it's, like, compounding a bad pass to him by making a worse pass to someone else.
He's certainly not Tompkins, that is for sure. But mind you, Tompkins wasn't great in international rugby for quite a long time.
Yeah, Tompkins, he's not Tompkins now, like...
Tompkins is so good now.
Yeah.
Tompkins...
Don't worry, but Ollie Lawrence will be back. It's fine.
Yeah, I don't think he moved Dingwall. I think you just stick with him because he's the only natural 12. Ollie Lawrence is dynamite at 13. Slade's dynamite at 13. You got loads of dynamite at 13s. Just stick with a 12. For God's sakes, just stick with one 12.
Stick with someone.
Stick with someone and just leave him there and let him develop. Because that's what Wales would do. They would find someone. I mean, that's what they have to do with their props. They'll try Archie Griffin, they'll try Azarotti, they'll try all of these
Tomachowski and Thomas and Leon Brown.
Eventually they'll find the next Francis.
Francis or Adam Jones.
Or someone.
Or Gethin Jenkins.
If they get two props, they're in serious business.
James Mulgain, basically I'll summarise his point by just asking a question. Freddie Stewart, discuss. Where do you stand on Stewart?
Stewart this week was doing lots of things which he's good at. And he executed them well. Stewart is still very flawed, particularly in defence. I think sometimes in the air, he's not as good as people think. Sometimes he's spectacular. Sometimes he does make...
On balance, he is exceptional.
Yeah, but...
At that one closed skill.
People say this, right?
No, he is.
He is some of the time. This game, he was imperious. I've seen him lose many, many high, many high
balls. He's imperious far more than he's...
Yeah, but that's not imperious then. it's got to be...
There's nobody more imperious than he is. I can't think of anyone who's more reliable.
Who gets in the air and challenged. Yeah,
I think he probably is the best in the world at that.
Izzy Folau back in the day?
Probably well, yeah, right Izzy Folau would have been. But
would have been, yeah.
I guess if you compare to Izzy Folau, you're pretty good on.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah, okay, fine. I'll give him that. Defence is his big weakness.
He didn't really get tested in defence this week. He carried well. He's for a fullback, he's a very, very good heavy traffic carrier because he's 100x kg.
Do you know what he does do a lot, though?
I know the most notable thing that he did this week was slip.
Yes,
carrying
he falls
ball
over.
Twice he slipped.
I've seen him do that for Leicester a few times.
He's when I was younger, particularly when it was wet, as a winger, I always used to wear long studs because my old man would bollock me. Like, absolutely. If I ever slipped because I've got fancy football boots with
good
blades
lad.
Or something on, no chance.
Yeah.
So I'd always be like 2 inch long, 25 mil metal studs.
I used to wear these ridiculous rugby league studs. Now, I don't know why rugby league players need such long studs, but I was told they were rugby league studs. I don't know if they were.
Rugby league was played in the summer as well.
Yeah.
But I used to wear those studs you're talking about, and this was in the days when a good bit of rucking was like part of the game.
I mean, it's one of those, it's like an urban myth, isn't it, that these studs are dangerous. Like, is a 2-inch stud or an inch and a half stud really that much more dangerous than an inch and a quarter? I mean, I just don't think it does that much. It's not like penetrating the skin.
No, exactly. the decisive element of whether they're dangerous or not is whether the person is scraping them down your back or not.
And whether they're sharp, like if they're...
Those you ones that the
got, like,
to get
ones got a plain tiny bit of metal, and then it's as soon as that's worn away, it's like hard plastic that gets to a real fine point.
So in football, like you know the drill in rugby.
Yeah,
I think they still do it at lower levels. They check everyone's studs, like the referee.
Yeah, you get
a stud check. It doesn't happen in football. I remember a school football match where I went in for a tackle, and there's two of us both went in. We both got the ball and sort of slid through, and then all we heard was just this.
Don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear anything like this. I hate it. Anything like this.
And the kid went to hospital. And basically, some parents and stuff came up to me afterwards and said, "Let me look at your studs." I looked at them and, yeah, they were exactly like you just described.
Yeah,
I shredded his inner thigh. He went to hospital.
His inner thigh?
Yeah.
How were you tackling?
Well, we both tackled. slid in and we were scissoring
above
each
the
other.
Knee.
We were scissoring each other, basically. And we were both on the floor sliding. But yeah, it's exactly that. I just lacerated his leg.
Oh, God.
Because of that. But I said, ref didn't check our studs, and they didn't really have an answer to that.
A really good friend of mine, Trav, we used to have our studs checked, and I used to wear these ridiculous long ones, and every time we got them checked, the gag would be every time he'd turn around and go, got away with it every time, and always made me laugh.
I've been through airport security and he makes exactly the same gag.
Got away with it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Nice. Okay. Actually, you just said something which just reminded me of this morning. Let's just have a little break from international rugby. We'll come back to Ireland and Italy in just a second.
Mm-hmm. Lancashire Cup quarterfinal.
Yeah, well, you just said about penalty counts.
Yeah.
And you're so right. And it's the bottom level of the game. So I was wrong today in my coaching role for Rafi Quirk's Broughton Park under-16s in their Lancashire Cup quarterfinal. And I said at half-time to the boys, lads, the team that gives away the fewest penalties will win this game. Just no pens. Get an extra half yard offside, trust your D, roll away, let them have the ball, trust your D, all the rest of it. And they went and proceeded to spend the entire second half, except for the last 5 minutes, in their own 22 from repeated stupid penalty decisions. Our boys were in their own 22.
Oh, God.
11-7 up. In a whole second half in their own 22, and it was the most heroic defence that meant they managed to win 14-7 in the end. And I was wrong. The team that conceded by far the most penalties won.
So you're going to tell them to concede more penalties next week?
More pens.
Correlation causation.
Correlation causation. They had no right. I don't know. It's one of those where, I was stood there. Bearing in mind you're a coach, I was going, I take no credit for this because I cannot believe they've won that game because everything about the reason they won the game was all the stuff you cannot coach. It was just heroic.
Awesome.
In Broughton Park, I never saw this story before, but I love it because it's one of the few times that a lesson was actually taught. You remember Broughton Park back in the day when we first arrived? We had a lot of big characters, a lot of people with a lot of things to say who all thought they knew everything about rugby. Like, and they still think they know everything about rugby to this day. And we had a game, the first team had played, and they'd given away a lot of penalties. So the coach, the forwards coach then, and probably still is now, Mark Lloyd, set up this little drill, this little square, and he threw a ball in. We've got two teams of forwards. It's only the forwards. And he went, go get the ball and play. And this square is maybe, it's like 5 metres by five. It might be smaller than 5 metres by 5 metres. It might be like 3 metres by 3 metres, right? Just go and play. And literally, as soon as the first guy goes to ground, there's like a ruck formed, and all the lads are screaming, he's got his hands in, like, he's doing this, he's doing that. Like, they all had something to say. And he just let it play over and over and over again. And the moral of the story was, like, you've got to play to my whistle. And it was just amazing to watch. Like, nobody picked up on the fact that he wasn't reffing. Or they did pick up on the fact, instead of reacting to it, they just started screaming. And eventually people realised, well, we can do this. You can put your hands in. So let's start putting our hands in. Let's stop complaining about it and get on with it. And it's just a really good lesson, which is you've got to react to how the game has been reffed.
Which is often something that certainly England have been criticised for.
Yeah. Mm. I don't know exactly how you teach kids this, though. Mm. I mean, you're going to have to get them in a line, aren't you? And I don't know. I don't know how... You've got to condition them to not want to make an intervention in that ruck. I guess that's where you're losing your penalties.
Yeah, it's exactly as you described Tommy Raphael's precision on when to and when not to and all the rest of it. That's all the stuff. But yeah, so...
Just on that, yeah. On the sheer number of penalties and the winning team conceded far more penalties, which in the England-Wales game, England did concede more penalties to Wales, although after the first half it was somewhat evened up. Did you hear Borthwick and Jamie George after the match in the press conference?
No, I did not.
Talking about their penalty target, which I thought was... I found it a bit weird. So Borthwick and Jamie George both said they targeted... Maro Itoje,
seven, wasn't it?
Yeah, Maro Itoje set the target of seven penalties or fewer, which is, I find that weird because it's always better. Like, why is seven tolerable?
Because eight is the magic number.
No, but less is always better.
Yeah,
or fewer is always better in this case.
So I'm pretty sure
six is better than seven.
Because I'm pretty certain there's research out there. Which has eight as the magic number, because we always used to talk about eight. So it did spree. It's always less than eight. I know what you're saying. Zero would be great.
Yeah.
Zero should be the number.
Zero would be great, but I guess there's some tolerable allowance because you have to be able to take risks.
Yeah. And I guess. But then once they reached seven, was it right, no risks now because we're not going over it?
Mm. And like, no, it's the other way around, isn't it? They get to one about 75 minutes. And
like, oh, we've got loads left.
Yeah.
Make some stupid calls.
But they, like, Borthwick joked that we conceded six of those seven in the first half, so it was an uphill battle in the second half, but the lads did it. The lads stuck to their seven.
To be fair to him, it absolutely stacks up. Because I think what happened, the way that this game was lost for Wales, was it was the penalty count catching up with them. So he was absolutely right.
I guess it's having targets, like having a time that you're going for. Like, it's got to be something that you think's realistic and achievable, but is also stretching you to.
Yeah,
because you could give away a penalty in the first second, and it's like, oh well, that's that gone.
Yeah, but why not six or why not like why?
Maybe the next game will be six. Maybe it's relative to how they'd got on in previous games.
Yeah, anything less than eight is awesome.
Yeah, well, Wales are nine in 160 minutes of rugby now.
Exceptional.
Including a second half where they had no scrum at all.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah. England deserve a lot of credit for this win because I think sort of to focus on the one area of the game where they could win the penalty, and I think George Ford as well second half is brilliant.
The 50-22 was outstanding.
Yes, it was.
He had absolutely nothing on.
Yeah, and so that's what's interesting. It was an outstanding bit.
But get rid of him. Get Finn Smith in. So yeah, get rid of him. Get rid of George Ford.
Outstanding bit of skill to thread that kick in.
Yeah, brilliant.
But he only had to do that because of exactly what you just said, that because he gets the ball, looks up, and there is nothing on. Like, the attack is non-existent. Therefore, he said, oh, I'm going to have to do this again, lads, and puts in a beautiful kick. And that's what... That was
the platform for this.
Oh, because that led to the yellow card, the deliberate knock-on.
What about the yellow cards? So this is
really interesting. Chesham.
The Chesham one is not... It might not even be a penalty, from what I can tell.
I wouldn't give it as a pen.
I wouldn't give it as a pen. And the referee said, oh, yeah, he can be lower.
Like, well, I mean,
how?
I mean, theoretically, I guess he could.
I mean, if he's laying on the floor,
yeah,
he can't make a tackle.
What's the coaching point to Ollie Chesham? Be shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't be 6'7".
I can't remember. What was the second one?
The penalty try.
Absolute Ethan, yellow card. Ethan completely Roots. Right.
I'm not sure about that one. Itoje had latched onto the ball, and the reason the yellow card was given is because...
He signalled pulling down.
I suppose. Actually, the fact... Yellow card I'm okay with. Penalty try, not okay with, because Itoje was on the ball.
I agree with... So, I've watched it a couple of times. I'm not 100% certain that there was like a deliberate pull down. I think it collapsed because of the pace of it.
Yeah, agreed.
But I'm okay with the yellow card, but... Both Itoje and Ben Earl. Itoje got on the ball and Ben Earl was around there as well.
Unless he was illegally on the ball.
A point of trivia, what was the thing that Nick Mullins got wrong in commentary? He doesn't get things wrong. But then later, weirdly, became right.
So I listened to the first half with no sound.
He got something really wrong.
Don't know.
Okay, so the penalty try occurs. Mm-hmm. And then a few minutes after that, the camera pans on to Martin Williams. And Nick says, there's Martin Williams. He, until very, very recently, he was the last man for Wales to score a first half try in Twickenham. And of course, he was wrong. Because it's a penalty try. He's still the last man to score a first half try in Twickenham. Luckily for Nick... Alex Mann bailed him out shortly later.
Was that second half?
It's first half, wasn't it?
Alex Mann was...
It was first half.
It was first half.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was right, because he obviously anticipated Alex Mann was going to score.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right at the end of the first half.
Yeah. Like, ooh. Ooh.
No, I listened to the first half without sound, so missed that.
Oh, and you were in the stadium?
I was in the stadium.
So you wouldn't have...
I didn't hear that. Yeah. I didn't hear that. I didn't actually see Nick either.
Yeah.
So no, I didn't. I'll tell you who I did see.
You went to the champagne bar, no?
the Bollinger tent. The most unexpected person that I chatted to and saw at the weekend. And if I asked you to guess, we would be here. We've been doing the podcast for how long? This is our 11th season. Another 11 seasons, and you wouldn't guess who it is. Former Chelsea, Leicester City, Stoke, and... Who else has he played for?
Robert Huth.
Correct. German centre-back Robert Huth.
Yeah. He's about 6'5", isn't he?
He was at the rugby, yeah.
So, when I went to England-Wales, my dad took us to a box once, which was pretty cool.
Did you get Robert Huth just from those clubs?
Yeah.
Oh, well, well played, mate. That's quite impressive.
I'm pretty good like that. I'm pretty good with Premiership footballers.
You've got this window of Premiership football from about... I don't know, 2003 to 2015, where you are weirdly good.
I'm reasonable at that. And in the box next to us was John O'Shea, Ryan Giggs, all the lads who just, Rio Ferdinand, all the lads who just sort of retired. Mm. So yeah, they do like their rugby.
So I, slightly different box-related story, but I was in a box at Man City a few years ago with a friend of the pod, Steve Elliott.
It was great hospitality at Man City, isn't
it? It is good.
It is awesome. It is really good. And the Sky box, we were on the corner where the Sky recording was being done. Went in for a pee at half time, or it might have been just after half time, actually, because they would have been recording at half time. Went in for a pee, and along next to me in the urinals, Seidel's very elegant French man, Thierry Henry. So I finish up, wash my hands, go back. I was like, Thierry Henry's just sidled alongside me in the urinals. And so Steve runs into the toilet and starts taking pictures of Thierry Henry at a urinal, which is such a... dickish thing to do.
Keep it cool. Keep it cool, Steve. Yeah, yeah. Keep it cool.
Fuck.
We shared a table with Martin Keown.
Yeah.
That was weird. So
I mean, I did realise maybe the most... middle class, but the most media sentence ever said, oh, Man City do great hospitality.
Yeah, they do.
Because I worked at XFM, did the breakfast show in Manchester. I used to get invited every now and again. I took JB to one. As he said, Martin Keown was on our table.
Yeah.
And a guy who was clearly a rock star.
But we didn't know who he was.
We didn't know who he was. All we knew is that he played Wembley the night before. And I looked. And it was like Led Zeppelin had played.
That's right.
And I was like, oh my God, we got like one of Led Zeppelin sat with us. No, no, he meant Wembley Arena, not Wembley Stadium. So it was Billy from
Billy Duffy.
It was Billy Duffy.
She
from,
sells the Cult.
The Cult. Yeah. There you go.
Oh. Now he had a very attractive girlfriend with him. So I think I must have been like 20. What were we? 28, something like that. Maybe. So,
yeah, we're around. It was about to,
we hadn't started the podcast yet.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we had.
Well, had we? Maybe we got one episode in. Like
it was early days.
It's early days, right? And she was there. Now I've looked her up recently. Would you believe it? AJ. Right? And I'm sure she's got a new famous boyfriend.
Oh.
I can't remember now. It seemed.
When did she pop into your mind? She just does from time to time.
So I think what had happened is I logged into an old Instagram account of mine or an old Twitter account of mine, and she was one of the people I followed. So I like followed five people, and I shut down my Instagram or my Twitter account, and that's how I found out.
Mm.
So completely innocent.
I wonder if she took half, because she was talking about the house and stables that they'd just bought.
Oh, I can only imagine. I can only imagine how delicious those royalties were.
So if you see the Cult back out on tour, now you know why.
It's like
paying for that break.
It's like Lawrence Delalio's motorway adverts.
God, every time I see that motorway advert, it reminds me to pay my tax on time.
Yeah.
Pay your tax in full on time, or you'll be working for motorway. And that's if you're lucky, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're really lucky, you'll work for motorway. If not, just pay your tax on time. Who would help you pay your tax on time?
I know. The premier financial advice agency in North Wales. And indeed the whole UK. Yeah. And the whole world.
Beardmore.
Beardmore and Co. Independent Financial Advisors, of course.
You see, I disagree that they're the people that would help you pay your tax on time. They would help you not only pay your tax on time.
You pay more tax because you're so wealthy.
Yeah.
Hang on, I can't say this. The FCA will be after me. I'm making no claims. I'm a financial advisor.
They would ensure your tax...
No, they wouldn't. We won't do that.
They would remind you...
We're just financial advisors.
They would dutifully remind you to pay your tax on time, but they would, more importantly... invest the hard-earned money you have to... Yes, you would. They would advise you.
I'm in such a deep legal hole now, Tim. I just want to stop.
Right, you are.
You just need to stop.
So again, in terms of middle class...
I'm going to be working for motorway, aren't I? After that.
In terms of middle class sentences, I can say, at Twickenham yesterday, I flew back to Manchester this morning... so I made the Lancashire Cup quarterfinal.
Oh, nice.
We're going back down to London tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
But it was worth the trip back.
Air miles.
As for, you said you had a story non-rugby related, JB.
Which one?
To touch upon.
The rugby league one. Yeah, okay.
Let's do that.
It's a bit negative, this, after the fun, jovial time that we've just had. So I went networking on Thursday, and I was lucky enough, to be given a presentation by... a guy whose name escapes me now, but if it comes back to me, I'll mention him by name. And I was subjected to two presentations. Well, one presentation about two sports, and it highlighted to me everything which is wrong with sports and why mainstream sport is dying, except for football. And just the exactly the sort of people that we don't need running sports. And unfortunately for this gentleman, it was just him. It was him through and through. Mm. So when watching this presentation about the Rugby League World Cup, what do you think, this is from the CEO of the Rugby World Cup, the main selling point of rugby leaguers?
The physicality.
Tim?
The main selling point?
The focus. So this is literally...
This is what they're saying.
This is what he said, the focus of the Rugby League World Cup. What is it? What gets people through the door?
I would hope it would be, physicality and
teamwork,
like, incredible physical
discipline,
skills.
Discipline, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that. Front and foremost, the Ribbley World Cup, there was one word they wanted to push: equality. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You have to be kidding me. So he said, and this was the most important picture that we have. It's like a woman and a man and a disabled person. I'm like, well, this is great. And I'm not saying they don't also deserve a World Cup. But this is not why I'm signing up to go and watch England versus Australia. I don't think anyone is signing up in order to go and watch England versus Australia. And he just missed every single important point about rugby league. You know, it's history, it's physicality, it's bravery, you know, the aggression. Everything which would inspire a young man to pick up a ball.
Or woman. But,
or, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, yes. Yeah, or wheelchair player, frankly.
Which is, I watched some during the last World Cup of the wheelchair rugby league, because I didn't watch any of it live.
What's the difference between wheelchair rugby and wheelchair rugby league?
Well, this is an interesting one,
broader,
right?
They are brutally, yeah. They are really good games to watch.
I feel that wheelchair rugby league and wheelchair rugby union could be kind of like the part of the territory where the Crips and the Bloods first make friends. Like, there's no need to have two different codes of wheelchair rugby.
Yeah. I'd love to try it. I'd love to have a go.
I think you probably could.
Brutal. It's absolutely brutal.
Of a guy who, I think he used to be captain of the wheelchair rugby union team for England, and he was out in Japan at the same time as we were. And I was meant to interview him for Rugby Dungeon. I never got around to it. But I'm sure we could fix it up.
I'd be terrible, because if there is any strength and endurance in my body, it's in my legs.
Yes, quite.
Not my upper body.
I'm exactly the same.
I'd be ruined.
We'd be screwed. We would be screwed, because their upper body strength must be absolutely mega.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. But I think there is quite a lot of able-bodied people that play, because they need the numbers. Mm. Mm, interesting. We'll look into that further. I'm sure someone listening will know the answer to that. So, anyway, this is what it starts with. I'm just thinking, you've got this back to front. And the things I'm most proud of is like, oh, equal pay for everyone. I mean, good. It's kind of good. Is it good? I don't know. Does it matter? No, it doesn't. The only thing that matters is that you're pushing rugby league. And all I could see is somebody pushing their own agenda. And the agenda and values, which are not important to any fans or anyone who supports rugby league, and if they are, they're like secondary or third order values, nothing to do with rugby league whatsoever. It was the most disappointing thing I've ever seen.
Sorry, you were going to continue.
Yeah, so then, but the next one, right, was his role in British cycling. So I've got some very strong views on how sports should be run. I don't know if I'm right, but I do have these views. So again, the most disappointing thing was the order of priority for British cycling. Do you know what the first order of priority is for British cycling?
It's going to be something like diversity, given what you've just said.
I would say it's health and fitness, because of the participation levels of cycling.
You would have thought so, right? The first,
yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Well, yes, and I've got some thoughts on that. So the first one, right? The first rung of the ladder was social justice. So let's go through it again. The first order for British cycling. The first part, and he's got these ladders, right? There's four different ladders. It's like social justice, social change, something or other. I'm like, who has put this guy in charge? And I think what it kind of demonstrates to me is there is a class of sports administrators, and I'm sure Bill Sweeney is in this class, who just hang around long enough and know what to say. Because from what I could tell, well, I asked the question, right? So I asked the question about...
I was about to say, did you get
involved? I got my hand up. And I was very careful, because I do appreciate this guy is giving us our time. And yeah. I do appreciate he's not being paid. So he's not come just to, you know, have me.
And you're there to network.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't mind putting my opinion forward in any scenario. But you have to be polite, I think. I think you can't really go hard at him. Because he has given up his time for this. So the question I asked was like, okay, for cycling in particular, I thought it's really concerning. They've got 7 different sports under the brand of British Cycling. So track, mountain biking,
BMX,
indoor cycling,
road race, indoor.
Oh yeah, the indoor, so you got cyclocross,
you've got
something
all,
like that.
All these different things, and then of course you've got men and women's. And I made the point that in rugby union we see union creep into all these different territories, like touch and sevens and 15s. They should all be run differently. The men and the women's game should be run differently. But the reason they do it is to increase the numbers so they can increase the funding. And this is what cycling are doing. So I put this to him, because, yeah, well, when you've got a decreasing pot of money, and that was the bit which killed me, because this guy isn't doing his job properly. On the one hand, he's saying our top BMXers are signing deals with, I think it's Paco Rabanne, he's got all this list of stuff. Like, well, in that case, BMX is fine. The last thing they need is you taking their money. What you're really telling me is you want some of that BMX money, not that you're supporting BMXing. I mean, that's a very different concept. So he's got seven sports under the banner of British Cycling. They're all completely different. They all serve different demographics. But the reason that they've done it is because they're trying to squeeze more money out of central government. And real leadership would say, well, that is BMXing. That belongs to this demographic. I'm sure we can get some money out of Red Bull, but why doesn't BMXing go and run itself? Right? What, Tour de France, that sort of road cycling. This is not short of cash. It is not short of corporate sponsors. So why does that need to be part of indoor cycling?
So I understand you're talking about the central pot of money, and I can understand what you're saying, but also my thought on this was, this is top down. This is basically governing bodies trying to satisfy the way that corporations are being run lately.
Yes, I think you're right. I think there's
you've talked about the Allianz money for England women's rugby. They were like, yeah, we'll give you some money, but actually we kind of want them.
I see what you're saying, yeah. So we'll sponsor BMXing if you give us Tour de France. Yeah. That kind of thing.
These DEI, all of that stuff, is all what corporations are doing. BlackRock and all the rest of it were saying now stepping back from, but
yeah, ESG, EDI, absolutely. So he's so well versed in this language, and one of the things he mentioned was one of the missions of the Rugby League World Cup was to decrease male suicide, something along those lines. And at that point, I could feel my blood boiling. I was like, excuse me. How many suicides did you prevent this year? Because I suspect it's zero, and you're just appropriating that cause in order to push your bona fides. And I'm sure that is the case. I mean, it makes me so intensely angry when people say things like, oh, yeah, we're doing it to prevent male suicide, but they can't back up any of those stats. If that went to the Advertising Standards Agency and they made that claim, it'd be thrown out. It'd be thrown out, but yet you can't challenge that because it's a good claim. But it's so cynical.
So what's your point as you relate back to rugby? It's just this is kind of a window into how you imagine rugby's being administered.
Yeah, this is exactly how the professional level of sports administrators, particularly in mainstream sport, behave. And because they come from one sport to another, they fail in one, they fail in the next, and they just carry on going. And the way that they make themselves succeed, and this was the Bill Sweeney trick, is you'll say, well, did you win the World Cup? And this is exactly what this guy says. Like, oh, it's not just about medals, it's about social justice. It's about making a difference. And they'll go, no, we didn't win medals. I mean, as it happens, British Cycling does. So that's good. That's really good. But they'll just say, oh, no, but we increased participation of East Indian ladies who like to go cycling. I mean, who cares? Like, who actually cares?
Well, all of those things that are mentioned are great outcomes.
They're outcomes, they're not the target.
They're all great outcomes, exactly. So you shouldn't. There's no one here would sniff at anyone picking up a rugby ball, getting on a bike, whatever. They're all great outcomes, or it helping with any number of potential issues. But it being the front and centre target is a strange.
Someone put their hand up. So I was questioning, like, how are you going to make cycling more accessible? I was like, it's cycling. And, you know, I go to CrossFit every morning at 6 a.m. and there is a range of people going to horrible jobs, all on terrible mountain bikes, and they look miserable, but they find a way to get to work on their bike. I'm not even sure you need a governing body for cycling, to be honest, for getting to work. But the answer was, we've been to Trek and we tried to get affordable bikes to give to the community. It's like, can Trek just not make the affordable bikes and sell them? Like, is this a good use of funds? It's not. So what they do is they say, look, here are the things that we thought we'd achieve. This is the Bill Sweeney trick. Okay, we didn't win the World Cup, but look, we've increased participation by appropriating touch rugby.
But there are loads of affordable bikes.
Of course there are.
They might not be as good as...
Second-hand
bikes.
Like, the last thing I need is a top-down administration handing out Trek bikes.
Trying to bend the market to its will. If there's a demand for affordable bikes, which there is, there are affordable bikes to buy, which there are.
And there are existing businesses and mechanisms which are incentivized to do it for minimum cost and maximum profit for them. And And then he went, oh my God, yeah, you just don't need people in the middle of that process. That already exists. There's eBay, there's Gumtree, there's, you name it.
Yeah.
There's little post-it notes put up on the supermarket board.
If you want to spend 12 grand on a bike, you can spend 12 grand on a bike. If you want to spend 50 quid on a bike, you can spend 50 quid on a bike.
If I was in the government department, right, someone came knocking, said, can I have some money, please? Why, are you going to win some medals? No, we're going to increase social inclusion. For cycling? My word.
Tell the Deliveroo drivers that you need more social inclusion.
Deliveroo has done more for cycling than British cycling.
I was sorry, I won't go into any details about this, but I was talking to a friend of the pod, CJ, about misappropriation of the market by local authorities at length yesterday, and some of the stuff that goes on is
criminal,
might be the only word. Yeah, it is eye-watering, some of the stuff that goes on.
The nexus between local authority and third sector and what they get up to, and it's just completely unaccountable, and people should be locked up.
And some of the distortions in the market, oh my word.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Other people's money getting spent
for other people's benefit.
For other people's benefit.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful. Yeah.
It's the classic, isn't it? Yeah. It's the absolute classic. So I watched this, and then unfortunately, my two guests, both solicitors, had to listen to my views on sports administration. I could hardly contain my rage about the mental health claim.
I can only imagine.
The suicide claim just nearly pushed me over the edge. How cynical do you need to be?
Do you know what? There are thousands of people, though, JB, waiting for your opinions on Irish rugby.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's do that then. Let's do that. So, last week I was scathing about Ireland.
this is why I hate Ireland. Yeah, with the line.
I've got to say, this week, okay, another worthless game. They won it. Well done. So, we've covered off that angle. Some of the rugby they played was magnificent.
It is.
And some of the talent. I was just thinking about the pack that they had in front of me, because Italy weren't up to much. So, it was a good time just to admire the magnificence of the Irish team. The second row combination is a joke. Yeah. It's just a joke now. Like the fact that they were playing Caelan Doris at seven. Where's Van der Flier? Didn't need him.
Yeah, on the bench. But the fact that you've got Tyburn
just
sitting in
stands. Have a rest. Baird, open blindside flanker
with Omani in the stand, Bundyaki in the stand.
Yeah, Hendo coming off the bench. James Ryan, who's now probably third choice out of this incredible stable of locks, and McCarthy, who's so deep. He's so like for thick. a man of his age. Now he's not Pasolo Tuilagi, but
I don't think you want that.
No, that is maybe too extreme. Yeah. He's some specimen.
He is. And like you can imagine being in Italy going, oh my God, we've still got 20 minutes to go. I'm absolutely blowing. At least they're making a change now. Good, we've got rid of who's coming on. Oh, World Player of the Year 2022, Josh Van der Flier. Brilliant.
Yeah. And Gibson Park comes off running everything from everywhere.
I mean, I have literally nothing to say about Italy after this game. Nothing at all. But the quality of Ireland's hands, like some of the invention in their attacking play was awesome.
Yeah, and so Italy scored three superb, like genuinely superb, attacking tries last week against England, and not a sniff. Like just no chance against this Ireland team. So comprehensively
shut
down.
I would say Ireland did some incredible things. Some of their handling was outstanding.
Wasn't it?
They shut Italy down, and I still would say that Ireland were third gear.
Oh, yeah, because they changed half the team. Well, so there's still some...
And also they did make some mistakes. Second half was a bit scrappy by their high standards.
Well, what I'd say about Ireland, and it's one of the few compliments that I'll give them, is like, they don't dip their game, do they? So if they've got a terrible team in front of them, they get hiding. I do like that, actually. It's not like England would sort of scrape through against Italy, and then there'll be a few other teams that will scrape through against Italy because they'll underestimate them. They are very professional in that aspect of the game. If they see someone in front of them who they can give good kicking to, they'll give them a damn good kicking. I do like that.
But they are not the kind of team who, like New Zealand put 96, was it that many?
New Zealand will do this. They're absolutely murderous.
But New Zealand will put 96 points on scene because New Zealand will just know, well, we can just attack everything from anywhere. Whereas Ireland won't. They will give them a kick in, but they'll do it in the same way as if they were giving the kick in to France or England or Wales or Scotland, because they will just play their beautiful patterns and systems and keep it going.
It does make me regret the World Cup, you know. When you see that team, and you know they've missed the boat. That team will not, unless they get even more good players, and they probably will in 4 years' time.
Well, yeah,
it's only going to go downhill from here.
Their age profile is good. Really good.
Is it? I mean, obviously McCarthy's young. James Ryan is probably only 26.
26,
yeah. I'd look at every position on that park, and you say the ones that are ageing have players waiting in the wings. Peter Omani has got Ryan Baird.
There's plenty of people to
replace. Ty Bird, him. Joe McCarthy.
Even Ty Bird's not...
He's not that. He's 31, 32.
Yeah.
So he'll be fine. Come another World Cup. But
he is quite explosive, though. That's the only thing about Ty Bird.
30, so he's 32.
He's 32.
So he'll be 35, pushing 36 in the next World Cup.
He won't make that World Cup, I don't think.
He might make the World Cup, but maybe not frontline player. Maybe he'll be second string by that point. But their age profile's really good.
Sheehan's a beast.
Oh, he's an animal. He is an animal.
Monster.
He is an animal. But tight head prop, I think, is one area they are not good enough.
Join the club when
Tadhg Furlong moves on.
Yeah, they've got Finlay Beelam, who started this game, and you've got Tom O'Toole, who is a handy, but he's only relatively young, certainly for a tight head prop.
They've got the Ollie Jaeger at Munster now, who hasn't been capped.
Yeah, he's got a weird route, hasn't he?
Yeah. He was Irish, but then went to New Zealand.
New Zealand for a bit because he got dropped by. Was it Leinster?
I think that rings a bell.
And he looks about 45, but he's not. He's not 45.
Yeah, but you're right. Tight end props are unicorns, aren't they? Good ones.
Pretty much are. I can't think of Scotland have a couple that were quite impressive. Who can push? England even struggled for him.
Yeah, Scotland have got one good tight end prop, and then they managed to eke out the World Cup with WP Nell, but. Behind that, I mean, it's Elliot Miller-Mills, who's he's been at Northampton and Ealing and what was he, Wasps and a few other places. But he, at 31, he's getting his first caps in.
Yeah, if you're, say, 16 years old now, and there's even a tiny inkling of you being good enough to play rugby in the front row, just work on being tight prop.
You
might make it.
But then it's, are you going to be big enough? Because that is that is one of those battles.
Yeah. But he can be just strong enough. I mean, like, if you look at the Welsh guys, they're not big enough. They put on a lot of weight, not good weight.
Like Archie Griffin, it's one of the things he's got going for him. He's 6'3 and 125 kg.
Is he 6'3?
That's what he's listed as.
His dad's about 6'5, 6'6.
Crikey.
So he's got the frame. He might not actually be any good at the moment, but once you've got the frame, you can get good.
And you can't
get good if you've not got the frame.
I do think about that being strong works until you get tired.
Oh, yeah.
And when tight head props get tired, then mass moves mass.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It just being big is important.
Hard.
Well, for that, Scotland managed it well, actually, but there was a period of time where they had Pasola Tuilagi, 150 kg, behind Duini Antonio, 150 kg, all going into Schumann.
But actually, it didn't make... I think too much is made of that, you know.
In that, it didn't. Like, Scotland handled it well.
What wasn't last week's the Scotland-Wales game? There was not a scrum in... In fact, was there something like two scrums yesterday? Some ridiculous stat? Or maybe no scrums in the first half?
I'm not sure.
In the Scotland.
Or maybe that was last week.
Oh, no, it was. Yeah, you're right. It was last week. Last week, no scrums occurred, effectively.
Yeah.
Mm. Which I'm sure Wales were very happy with that last week.
Yeah.
Wales, they were incredibly happy with that.
But their line-out fell apart instead. And this week their line-out was a bit better.
Line-outs falling apart is just not acceptable.
Well, France, in the first half, particularly with Malvacaron, their line-out was shaky. And it was targeted by, so obviously they knew. Marchand shored it up a little bit when he came
out. I'm certain, in the pro game, I'm certain about this, it's happened to me as well. I don't think it's the technicality of the line-out getting up and down and throwing. I think it's the mindset of the caller. I think people get in the mindset of the caller and that's where it goes wrong. And they start calling the wrong balls to the wrong areas.
It's the hot hand approach. You see streaks of it.
Yeah.
Like once there was, which game was it? There was one of the games in the World Cup. I want to say it was Ireland, South Africa, where Kelleher started because Sheehan, he might not have been back fit at that point. Sheen was certainly injured for the start of the tournament. And South Africa just threw two maybes like Mostert and Pieter Steftetoy up at every single line out. And it was three or four on the bounce that Ireland lost because they had the call.
Yeah.
They knew they were going to attack everything and they just couldn't hit their, jumpers.
I'd love to know. I need to speak to someone again about this because I have spoke to line-out callers in the past about what they're doing. But I wonder if they are limiting their... They must be limiting their defensive calls to what they think that the attack will do, obviously, like regarding field position. So I imagine they're never defending the front. So, you know, halfway you were looking at the back and the middle. And therefore you're tempting the throwing team to go to the front. And then the other thing which the throwing team does, which annoys me, is too many dummies. Because once you've dummied twice, you've got to go. Like, it's a signal not necessarily to your team, it's a signal to the defensive team. You've got to get in the air now. So if you're slow, if you're just up and down, you can beat them in the air. But because of the length of the throw, actually you do get time to react at middle and back ball.
Yeah,
but if you've dummied twice, if you're slow in the air, so he's dummied once. Oh, okay, we're ready now. He's dummied twice. Okay, we're still not off the air. Oh, third time we're in the air.
Goodhart's law.
What's that?
I couldn't think of it before. When we're talking about the England penalties, Goodhart's law is when a measure becomes a target, it's no longer a good measure. And that's so like making the measure of 7 or 8 or whatever it is, making the number the target. There's something there it just fails to do with
its
purpose.
It's a little bit like what I sometimes say about the... Well, so it's in reverse. It's slightly different back to front. But similar principle to I'm not a massive fan of tackle counts or missed tackles because actually you could be flying out of the line and trying to cover for one of your teammates... And technically, missing a tackle, that the quality of what you do is as important.
So, yeah,
or maybe more important than
to
the
use an investment term on missed tackles. That is a stat that needs a cap and a collar. There's probably a healthy range. So, you probably don't want to be under 20% and that, of made tackles.
The cap and the collar is a better way of thinking about it rather than saying we're no more than 7 or no more than 8 or whatever it is. It's saying, yeah, we want to be in this band.
Yeah,
anything like, and particularly compounding them, which England do historically terribly, is a dreadful way to go.
Now, this is a law that's only known amongst a few people, and I don't think you're one of them, Tim. You know what Logan's law is?
Logan's law.
He's got his own law.
What would Phil's law be?
Very well known within a select group of people.
Logan's,
and it explains a lot.
Logan's law. No, I'm. You've got me now. Tell me.
Logan's law is people are stupid.
Basically, that's the be all. That's it.
What about that Logan's law?
People are effing idiots, and you can't trust people. Like, if they do stupid things, it's because that's what they do. Like,
people are stupid.
Can I tell you from my own personal life? Like, the most impressed I've been with my kids was earlier today. In a lot,
please tell me that they sold sweets using a multi-round simultaneous auction.
I mean, that would be impressive. They had a party last night.
You were away.
We were away.
They
had a party, and I didn't know until this evening, just before doing this podcast. In fact, because the neighbour. Message to one of the neighbours' messages to say everything all right after last night. But I'm not annoyed with the kids. I was unbelievably impressed when I said, "So what happened last night? What, nothing? Why? What?" And I showed them the message, and they were like, "Oh, what happened? We had a party." Okay. And anyway, they went through in intricate detail that they taught me through their thinking for. What bits that they moved into the living room out of the way. They even took photos of... There's a load of jam jars full of marmalade on the table in the kitchen because Kate and some friends just made some marmalade the other day. They took a photo of how the jars were arranged and put them back exactly the same. And the meticulous... I would never have known... I just admired it. I was like, yeah. And I was like, how many people were there? About 60. 60 people
Goodness
were there.
Me.
Wow.
They cleaned us out of our beer 52 beers, by the way.
Oh.
I mean, if anyone's judging, that was I drank them all. Miners did not drink.
By the way, beer 52, that was a long time ago. a long time ago.
Yeah.
So you must have been holding on to those beers.
No, they sent some more a few months back.
Did they? Do you remember them?
I think. Or no, maybe not.
What was I going to say? Yeah, I got caught when I was 16 having a party in my friend's house. A similar sort of scenario. And the reason we got caught is we hung up the pictures in the wrong place. So we took all the pictures down and we put the pictures up, but we got two of them mixed up. And then eventually we got busted and it wasn't nice. They were not proud of us.
So I'm reading The Spy and the Traitor, which is a really good book. Only about 100 pages in. But it's a real story about a Russian spy who was working as a double agent for MI6. It's absolutely fascinating. But one of the things he does when he leaves his apartment, he puts a little blob of glue, just a tiny little bit, on his door, and he checks it as soon as he comes back in, because it doesn't offer any resistance, but he knows if the glue is broken every time he comes back in, so he knows if he's been bugged or tampered.
John Lucari does that with a grain of rice.
Yeah, so you should do that on your Beer 52 locker, Tim.
Yeah. Might not be a beer. Your
beer locker.
All the beer in my house from
Phil.
Yeah. All the
The Wheatwood. Was it Wheatwood?
Wheatwood.
Yeah. All the beer in my house is gone.
Yes.
It's gone to a good home.
It went to a good. Yeah.
Memories were made with that beer.
Yeah. Put yourself in their position.
Would you do it?
That beer would taste sweeter.
Yeah.
There you go.
The more I asked them, like that, I swear the house was tidier when I got back than when I they were on their own Friday
every
and Saturday night. It was great. Yeah. It's good.
Awesome.
Any more? Any other business?
I don't think so.
We've got a fallow week now, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. So now we can get into some real niche topics next week.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to that. That'll be really good, actually. Why can't Fijians pass a ball?
What?
Why can't Fijians pass a ball?
Is this a joke?
No. It is legit.
What? I don't agree.
Well, you're wrong. So, I was having a discussion, and somebody pointed this fascinating fact out about Fijians. A lot of Fijians, when you watch them at pro level, are not particularly good at passing the ball. They are amazing at catching, but not passing. Why would this be?
I don't know.
Tim, think about it. Why would you be amazing at catching but not passing?
Because they're so good physically that they rarely need to pass the ball.
No. Something else? What are they playing with?
Coconuts.
Almost. They're quite often playing rugby without a ball on the island. So on occasions, in fact, quite a few occasions, one of their favourite things to play touch with on, say, a beach or a field or whatnot, is a bottle filled with sand or water to give it some weight. Therefore, passing is really difficult, right? But their catching develops incredibly.
Wow.
Is this from Mark Evans?
I'm not telling you where it's from, because I don't know if he wants it publicised. That is phenomenal.
It feels like a... I'm not sure, even sure if it's podcastable, that little section.
Why?
I remember the time that I talked about some great result for Fiji. It might have been around the sevens, and I mentioned, imagine them all huddled around their little TV in the hut, I remember you two ripping me for
around their mud huts. Yeah, and I think my exact response is that's pretty disparaging to the Fijian tech entrepreneur.
Yeah, yeah, they're all. A lot of people in Fiji, Australia, New Zealand, that side of the world, they genuinely make money from online gambling, because like 8 a.m. Saturday morning or 8 a.m. Sunday morning is whatever time it is on the previous night in America. So you get all these drunk Americans going online
and they brilliant.
Hammer them at poker. And just take all their money playing drunk Americans at poker because of the benefit of the time zone.
Here's another little Fiji fact. So Fijian rugby is played by the Fijian majority, right? So 80% of Fijians are Fijian, right? And then the other 20% are also Fijian, but they're of Asian heritage, particularly Indian, because, of course, it wasn't quite a colony, but so. So all the Fijians own all the land, but all the Asians, generally speaking, are more into business and trading and commerce. So the Fijians play it, but it's all sponsored by the local businesses and supported by the Indian population, which I found, again, fascinating.
That is fascinating.
And, of course, they own all the businesses, but they can't own any of the land, and that's a hangover from colonial times. So only the Fijians can own the land.
Mm.
Any more Fiji facts?
No, let's have some more niche stuff next week.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, we've got plenty of time for it.
contact@chasers@gmail.com is where you can email us in the meantime on anything that this episode has sparked or anything you feel like talking about. Generally speaking, you can get us wherever you get your podcasts. Hit subscribe, and for more content, some of it spicy, patreon.com/eggchasers. I reckon, as Matt Cotton would say, let the boys end.
Yep.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's Amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.